Yeah. You're checking out the Slam Magazine Respect the Game podcast. You heard it first from your boy, Jay.
All right, what's good, world? It's your boy, Pete Walsh, a.k.a. Lamborghini Petey. Episode 47 of the Respect the Game podcast. Here, as always, with my boy, Abe Schwadron. Abe, how you feeling, sir?
Yo, a.k.a. Abraham Lincoln Bio. I'm fighting a little bit of a sore throat today.
Yeah, but you played through injury before.
And I wasn't going to miss this one.
No way.
No way.
You know, Abe and I, we love doing this podcast. And, you know, every once in a while, we're blessed to be in the presence of greatness. Blessed to be in the presence of an OG basketball legend, icon, someone we both grew up, you know, watching highlights of, really, you know, trying to do the layups and the dunks in the driveway.
I had to lower the rim just a little bit.
A lot of it. But none other than Julius, Dr. J. Irving. Julius, hey. How are you, sir? Thank you for joining us.
I'm doing good, and I just have to let Abe know I got to lower the rim now.
Wait, I thought
Times change.
As of a couple of years ago, you could still dunk.
I could on a 10-foot basket. Now we would probably have to work on a 9-foot basket. Now, okay. I could put on a show on a 9-foot basket. All right. But that 10-foot, it might be a challenge. Might be. I'm not saying it is, but it might be.
So there's no chance. I mean, we know you're involved with the big three. There's no chance you actually suit up.
That would be no. I don't think I'll be suiting up with the big three. I'm just going to, you know, be the guy at the helm. And we're going to have five players, probably have an assistant. And we'll just see if we can win some of those games. You know, I mean, everybody knows enough about the game from top to bottom. You got players who still have competitive juices, who still have the ability to run and jump, probably not, you know, conditioned for full court basketball, but they are conditioned for all-out basketball.
So is this your first, venture into coaching? Have you ever tried your hand at coaching before?
Actually, I'm 1-0 in coaching professional players. You know, I was when I was with the Virginia Squires, and Al Bianchi got kicked out of the coach. He got kicked out of the game. The assistant coach had been kicked out before.
Yeah.
Johnny Kerr. Then he got kicked out. And on his way out, he said, "You coach your team the rest of the way." And we were playing the Nets of all teams. And so I coached for the fourth quarter. I was a player coach for the fourth quarter. And we won the game. So I figured, you know, 1-0 is good. I might want to keep it at that. So now we're putting it at risk.
I was going to say, now you might not keep that perfect record intact.
Putting it at risk, man. But, you know, what's life without taking some risks?
Yeah. So did you draw every play up yourself in that fourth quarter? You said, I'm going to take the ball.
Well, you know, I did a lot of isolations. I did a lot. Like, give me the ball. Give me the ball and get out the way.
Well, you know, Abe and I were doing a little research earlier this week, and, you know, back in 92, you kind of, like, set, I guess, not the precedent, but did something similar to the big three when you and mm-hmm. Kareem played one-on-one
right.
in the clash
right.
with the Titans. And, you know, Abe and I were like, man, these two guys packed the gym out even.
Yeah. There were so many people there.
Yeah.
It was interesting because I think there were a total of 10 players. And so we had, Artis Gilmore was matched up, and Connie Hawkins, Rick Barry were matched up, Tiny Archibald. I forgot the other guys who were involved. And as it turned out, I probably should have played Connie or Rick, and Kareem should have played Artis.
Yeah.
But Kareem and I were the biggest draws, and there was a lot of hype around it. So I played a lot of one-on-one basketball against various seven-footers. And I did most of the promoting of the event. And in the day of the event, I tied on a microphone and was playing with these gloves on that we were promoting.
Yeah,
hot hands.
Gloves. I was wondering about
hot
that.
Hands. And then when I was down 10-0, I had to take the gloves off, take the microphone off. I said, well, at least I got to get a dunk in there on him, and ran in and slammed one, but got dusted off in the game. And that's why we never had a rematch.
But that's kind of... I mean, we were, you know, a lot of people have been wondering, oh, is anyone going to show up to these big three games, like, depending on who the players are? But that seems like a good model.
You know,
I mean, that place was packed.
You're absolutely right. I think, and we're at the Barclays Center. So, right. I mean, maybe we're not going to sell out the Barclays Center, but, you know, they can do modifications
right.
and, you know, allow for an 8,000, 4,000, 2,000, you know, whatever. So, whatever that number becomes projected. And they can modify the seating so so look full and move everybody down.
Yeah.
But I think with Ice Cube, you know, being at the helm of the league and Roger Mason as commissioner, I think they're going to come up with some really good ideas how to encourage people to spend their entertainment dollar. So it won't only be the game and the fact that, you know, you got a lot of Hall of Famers as coaches, but I think there'll be some ancillary stuff in between the games and maybe before and after the games, concert, what have you. So there'll be some brainstorming. It's still several months before it kicks off. And I'm kind of excited about being a part of it.
Absolutely. You know, being that, you know, we're back in, or you're back in New York, excuse me. You know, we want to take you back a little bit and just ask you about, you know, your days at Rucker Park. Abe and I try and get up there at least once a summer, you know, see what's going on in the street ball circuit. So, you know, obviously when you were playing there, you know, huge draw, you had people on rooftops coming out to watch you. So, you know, what are some of your favorite memories from playing at Rucker?
People on rooftops watching me.
I cannot relate.
No, interestingly enough, the first year I played there, you know, I was 21 and just finished my junior year of college. And I had never played in Rucker Park before. And I, you know, was played everywhere in New York, Long Island, Queens, but I never played in Rucker Park. And so now I signed with the Virginia Squires, and I have Charlie Scott as a teammate. And Charlie's from Harlem, great player at North Carolina. So, you know, Charlie was a big deal, and he had played in the park many, many times. So Charlie and I were in Virginia, and we used to, you know, commute from Virginia on the weekends just to come and play in the park. And then, you know, I go out and visit my folks out in Long Island, turn around Sunday evening, heading back to Virginia in Charlie's car. And, you know, he had this big flashy car. It was a Cadillac El Capilera. You know, it had these big, big headlights on it or whatever. It was convertible. And it was a sweet ride. So anytime he pulled it up, you know, he probably would, you know, give a kid $2 to $5 just to watch his car. Said, "Look, don't let nobody touch my car." Kids say, "All right, I got it, Mr. Scott." And, you know, he'd take care of him. And then we'd go in the park, and, you know, we really had to kind of like weave through the crowd of people to get in. You actually literally had to push some people out the way to get in, because they're just standing there, and they're just, you know, it's a free show. You know, you got NBA players, ABA players, you got park, the neighborhood legends, you know, coming, and there's no admission. It's first come, first serve. So first people there get the best seats. And so, you know, it was really all new to me.
Yeah.
And it was really like the coming out party for me, because the previous two seasons playing college ball at UMass, in my sophomore year, they took the dunk shot out of the warm up.
Right.
And then my junior year, they took the dunk shot out of the game. And it was mainly because of, you know, Lou Alcindor at UCLA. Mm-hmm. They were trying to, you know, negate his dominance. So they took it out, but it really affected me, because, you know, that was my highest percentage shot, and I was a leaper. And we, you know, we used to set some plays to throw the alley-oop play and catch it in the air, and, you know, throw it down or lay it in the rim. So so now I was able to dunk. You know, I thought I was playing in a 48-minute game, but as you guys know from going up to the park, you know, some of those games are like 60 minutes or 72 minutes, because the guy on the clock, you know, he's not running the clock the way he would run the clock. You know, that's why guys score 50, 70, 80 points in these games, because they play so many minutes. Yeah. You know, you're out there on the court. It's not because you're so good. It's just because you're in shape and you know, you get a lot more minutes. So it's like playing 3 or 4 overtimes. But it happened, you know. I mean, a lot of them came to see Charlie, and I was, you know, it was kind of like Batman and Robin, and then Robin started to go to center stage because, you know, there were things that came out of me that I had been saving up for a while in my college career, and playing, you know, organized a game as we were playing. And we were a team at UMass. We scored 80-plus points a game, but here we were scoring like 120, 130, 140. Or whatever. So it was just an elevation to the next level. And I think it really prepared me for the pros, because it helped me build my confidence. and let me know that I could play in the pros.
Do you ever wonder, you know, because obviously now if something like that was happening, or even when it does happen now in New York, every single person in the crowd has their phone up, they're recording it. Do you ever wonder what that scene would have been like? Or is it cool that it didn't, that you didn't have that because it's so like mythical now, you know?
Man, I'll tell you, like this morning, you know, we were down on the stock exchange, right? So these are, you know, sophisticated people and, you know, they're charged with a lot of people's money. So they're really responsible and whatever. And as we kind of weave through the stock exchange, I mean, every other person had their phone, wanted to take a selfie or, you know, just getting a glimpse, doing some video or what have you. And, you know, it's not something that, you know, you want to go through every day. So they didn't have athletes or Hall of Famer coming through every day, but they've been around people.
Right.
But they, you know, reality was if they could show little to no sophistication, can you imagine a crowd up at Rucker Park with those phones or whatever? And then, like, if you just kept moving or they didn't get their shot, they could be very persistent, you know, start pushing forward. And I've seen a crowd like that. So I was glad it wasn't like that back in the day.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was, you know, rare footage, which, but there is footage. I'm glad there is footage, but I'm glad it's not on everybody's, you know, phone. And that keeps it special.
Yeah. And I think back, what was it when Kevin Durant came through and he had
66.
Yeah, 66. Mm-hmm. And it was like the biggest story, I mean, on the internet for a couple of days. I just, you know,
and it ran.
Yeah.
Now you know why.
Yeah.
The clock. This guy's like, there's 3 minutes left in the game. Then about 5 minutes later, there's 2 minutes left in the game. Then about another 5 minutes, there's 1 minute left in the quarter.
So. I'm curious. You said, you know, playing at Rucker helped build your confidence and helped you for the pro game. You know, the ABA, excuse me, had, you know, that up and down style, fast paced style. Do you think the two styles of play on the street ball circuit and the ABA circuit were similar?
Yeah, the Rucker fed into the ABA very well, and then the NBA is the ABA right now. I mean, the way that they play, 3-point shot, the referees, up tempo style, guards, you know, really going beyond what they even did in the ABA. I mean, we had guards who were really good in the ABA and exploited the rules and the landscape as far as 3-point shots and so on and so forth. But now you have guards as the dominant forces in the NBA. And, you know, I mean, these are guys who are thinking score first and run the team second. And, you know, if you look at Harden, you look at Westbrook, I mean, you look at, you know, the better guards in the league, you look at Curry. LeBron plays guard half the time, guard forward center, nine yards. You know, that guy with the ball in his hand is really the dominant force, and he's not trying to defer as was the case when I played with Maurice Cheeks. I mean, he would defer to me. Andrew Toney, as good as he was, he would still defer. And, you know, they were trying to get their players in position to score, even though they could score themselves. You know, this is just the way the game was played. You know, you generally try to defer to the guys who were shooting the best field goal percentage and gave yourself a chance of, you know, scoring with efficiency and consistency. So now I think it's changed. And I'm not going to say it's changed for the better or it's changed for the worse. It's just changed because the game has evolved and athletes have evolved. And I think fan appreciation has also evolved. So there's, you know, people want to see instant gratification stuff. They want to see more highlights. And, you know, it's harder to keep people's attention span, you know, to sit through the chess match that used to go on with a lot of games and a lot of, you know, a lot of great football, baseball, basketball games, even hockey games. It was like a chess match. And, you know, you get there at the beginning of the game and, you're exhausted by the end of the game because you're trying to figure things out. And now there's no figuring out, whatever. I mean, it's just like, you know, get an exciting quarter in, and a team could be down 20 points in the first quarter, and you know they're going to come back.
Yeah.
Because the other teams always let them come back. Right. And, you know it's going to, at some point, be a game, unless it's really late in the game and the team is just getting blown out. And then, you know, you're just kind of along for the ride, and you're looking around at all the other things that are going on in the arena.
So before we have plenty of, you know, NBA-related questions on that sort of note, but before we sort of move away from – Rucker. The New York and Rucker stuff. I just wanted to know, you know, because there's actually a group of kids now in the New York, New Jersey area. They call themselves the Jelly Fam. Okay. Their signature move is a finger roll, and I think they came together through a lot of social media stuff. But I'm wondering for you, number one, how did you sort of like assemble your sort of crew of guys? Like, did you meet people in different boroughs and say, oh, you should come play with us next time? Because obviously you couldn't have done it through Twitter and Instagram. So how did you pick those guys up, and what did you call yourselves?
Yeah, it's interesting because we were Rough Riders, you know, from Long Island. And this is pre-Rucker, okay? So in high school at age 16, I would say, you know, we generally had a guy who was 17 who had a car. And, you know, we had a guy named Robert Mayrant, actually, and he had moved out from Brooklyn, and he was 19. So he had a Rambler. And a Rambler was a heck of a car. Right? See, he used to lay back. You could sleep in the car. Sleep in the car while you're driving.
Okay, so step one is just having
physically. So you got to have some wheels, car. Right? Yeah. You know, because we weren't going to play ball by bus or train or whatever. Right. We had a car because we were on the island, you know. So, and we had Leon, Ralph, and Odell, Lenny, and guys who we went to Roosevelt High School with. So we were basically Rough Riders, and we looked for games. I mean, you know, we played together for 4 years, freshman ball, and we played all the sophomores. We all played JV, and then juniors, we all made the varsity and moved on for 2 years of varsity basketball. And we were always looking for the best competition. And, you know, Robert knew people in Brooklyn, so every now and then we could communicate with somebody in Brooklyn, and then we'd go over to Brooklyn, we'd play in Prospect Park, or we'd play over in Brownsville. And when we went into Manhattan and Queens and the Bronx, you know, we just looked for parks. And it was one story when we were in Brooklyn and we were in Prospect Park and we were like playing, and we have our, you know, little shirts on. Some of them have Roosevelt on them. They're like T-shirts. And we played these guys and we played, you know, we played really well, won most of the games that we played. And we decided we'd trade shirts. So we got their shirts and they got our shirts, and their shirts had Brooklyn on them, you know. Mm-hmm. So we come back through Queens. We said, man, we still want to play. It was like Saturday afternoon, maybe about 4 or 5 o'clock or whatever. We've been playing ball all day. And we stopped in Queens. So we go to this park and, you know, we're just looking for pickup games. So the guys who we played in Queens, you know, we played them and we beat them. And then we said, what's the best way to get out of here and leave and head on back to Long Island? And they were like, Long Island? He said, oh, we thought y'all guys were from Brooklyn. I mean, we let some guys from Long Island beat us? Wait a minute. They felt bad about it. They said, no, y'all just get out of here, man. We ain't giving you no directions.
Wait, you didn't even wash the shirts?
No, man. You just put it on. Wow. That was it. Just went with the shirts.
I mean, that's
real sweat, man.
Yeah.
That's some real sweat.
That's also, I mean, that's becoming sort of a tradition now in all sports, really, guys like swapping jerseys after games. So.
All right, see, I didn't know. I know we did it back in the day, started so it's not it's not a new, so it's not a new thing.
Gotcha.
You know?
I just want to talk a little bit more about your ABA career. And in 76, you know, it was the first dunk contest ever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And number one, why did they decide to do it at halftime of the game? I didn't fully understand that. And number two, what do you think of, you know, the direction that dunk contest has gone in present day, like with all the props and people jumping over cars and using drones to catch mm-hmm. dunks and all that? So mm-hmm. what's your take on that?
Yeah. Well, you know, the All-Star game, like now, you know, it should be just labeled All-Star Week.
Yeah.
So it's Monday to Monday. And before, if you got in Friday and you had practice on Saturday and you had downtime, dinner with friends and family or what have you, then the game was on Sunday. So it was pretty simple. So everything needed to be, I mean, they only had the contract in the arena for Sunday.
Yeah.
So everything needed to take place there.
Gotcha.
On that particular day. And, you know, that last year of the ABA, it was even more interesting because you know, the league had filtered down to 7 teams. So, you know, initially when I got into the league, it was 14 teams. And it went down to 11, and it was 9. So it got down to 7 teams. So they said, okay, here's how we're going to have an All-Star game. We're not going to do East and West. We're going to have whoever the first place team is in the Western Conference, which was the Denver Nuggets. That team is going to play against All-Stars from all the other 6 teams.
Oh, wow.
So that's the way that was set up. And they don't even talk about that anymore.
Yeah.
But that's the way it was set up. We were literally playing against the Denver Nuggets. And the All-Star, slam dunk competitors came from all the teams. So David Thompson was, you know, the main guy with Denver. And you had Larry Keenan, who was with San Antonio. And Marvin Barnes, who was with St. Louis. Artis Gilmore. And George Gervin and myself. So we were like the original guys to do the slam dunk contest. And I think David was probably favored because he was a Skywalker and it was home court and the whole deal. And, you know, thank God he missed one. And there was a big penalty for missing because, you know, he came out of the corner and did a 360 and, you know, it ended up hitting the back of the rim or whatever. So, you know, my dunks were good. And the one from the foul line obviously was super spectacular. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it was my fate that, you know, all these years later, you know, that's still a superhuman feat that happened when people hadn't seen very much of it, if any of it.
I like how you said that they were just good. Your dunks were all right, except for that one.
Except for the one for the free throw.
The rest were all right. So, but what do you think it is now? I mean, people, a common thing you hear is, oh, the dunk contest is dead.
Yeah, well, as you and I have discussed, you know, we feel like all the props is just too much. I feel like Zach LaVine 2 years ago set the blueprint.
Well, I'd just rather see like 8 or 10 guys out there doing different. I don't know. What do you think
last couple of years there was no element of surprise, and then in Orlando, you know, and then this year, you know, the element of surprise was back. You know, it's just like, okay, he did well. He dunked behind his back. He under his legs, and he's, you know, floating on a red carpet or whatever. You know, what the heck is going on here? So people started to see things that, you know, make them go, oh, wow, make them stand up, you know, make them, you know, feel a little different. So I think part of the, you know, slam dunk contest is the element of surprise having an impact, being able to, you know, shock the audience and spike the ball.
Has anybody ever, any current guys ever reached out to you, either for advice or, you know, I want to dunk over you in a dunk contest?
Just online.
Like who or what did they say?
No, I'm only kidding. You know.
So was that, you know, when you dunk from
That available.
So when you dunk from the free throw line, was that strictly like, you know, as you said, element of surprise?
Well,
you know?
for me, there have been some buildup.
Yeah.
Because Doug Moe, who was coaching the Nuggets, Larry Brown, and Kevin Lockery, you know, they had started a conversation, and Lockery had told him, he said, you know, Julius is going to win the contest because he's going to dunk from the free throw line. Nobody else can do that. Mm-hmm. You know, he can't dunk from the free throw line. And, you know, it's like, okay. So they had a little side bet. And when I used to do my clinics for Converse, I used to always end the clinic, like going to half court, running and dunking from the free throw line, and continuing straight out of the building, you know, right to the locker room, change clothes. So nobody would say, come on, do it again. You know, because you know how kids are when you give them a clinic and you do something, they're like, oh, man, do that again. I missed it. You know, you get one shot, you get one look, that's it. So it's out of the building.
One memory.
So I've been doing that for a while, you know, and I knew I could do it. And there was a requirement then to jump from, you know, let's say the foul line is 15 feet away. There was a hash mark like 13 feet away. Mm-hmm. So they had a hash mark there because they said, you got to jump from these 5 different spots, from behind these 5 different spots, or from these 5 different angles. So the one in the middle, you know, was 13 feet. So I had a lot of room, and I ended up stepping on the line just to make sure. and, you know, going up and completing the play, but I couldn't run out of the building. But it did bring the house down.
Yeah, understatement.
Fortunately.
So who are some of, as far as dunking in today's game, who are some of the guys that you like to watch or that you think?
Today's game?
Yeah, today.
Well, you know who's an interesting and exciting dunker? Westbrook is a very interesting and exciting dunker. I like Kawhi Leonard. I just his all-around game. When he attacks the hoop, he kind of reminds me of myself because, you know, he has a big hand. Yeah, he can cup the ball, and he can do some things left-handed and right-handed that, you know, just makes the play. And if a guy doesn't have a big enough hand and can't control the ball, he can't make that play. So he's one of my favorites to watch.
Well, it's funny because didn't we see somewhere that someone tried to call you the Claw as a nickname? And that's the nickname that
they call him the Claw now?
Well, kind of.
You got to shake that off, man. That's a bad name.
Yes, thank you. I was just about to say that.
Who wants to be the Claw?
Nobody. It's a horrible nickname.
But sound like a horror movie, right?
Why are they? I mean.
So we got to give Blake love, though, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can't talk about dunks without mentioning Blake. And, you know. And Blake, and then last time I saw Blake play live, probably was two seasons ago, and he went for 45. And I was like sitting in the front row with my son, out in L.A. And his son was like, you know, he's showing off for you, right? And at the end of the game, yeah, like 45. I was like, what? I guess he was showing off for somebody.
Well, why
he was definitely putting it to him.
Yeah. Why do you think there's so many? I mean, I guess. Bad nicknames in the league now. Like, there's the Claw. I mean, CP3 is a
great.
Not
as natural.
Yeah, I mean, like Dr. J. Yeah. You know, you're so synonymous with that name. So why? Like, what do you think has changed? Why
can't Kawhi Leonard get a real nickname?
Yeah,
look at his real name.
Yeah, that's actually a great
nothing
point.
Nothing common about that. True. I mean, who names his son Kawhi? Right. So
yeah, I was thinking
the point.
It's different and. They wanted to go. They didn't have to think of anything super creative.
Same for LeBron.
All they could do is call him Kawhi.
Like,
but,
yeah.
Right?
Chris Stapps.
You know?
So
that's what did they call Chris Stapps?
I mean, a couple years ago.
What's his nickname?
But his rookie year, there was a big thing going around like the tabloids. Like, what's his nickname going to be? Uh-huh. And, you know, they settled on what? It was like KP6, something like that.
Oh, okay. Nothing good.
But,
okay.
And
isn't it all subjective, though? I mean, when you you need to hear it and you like it or you don't. You know, it's like tasting food. You like it or you don't. I mean, you know, it's just. And that if that person likes it, then you need to respect that because, you know, they're gonna brand it. They're going to market it. You know, I mean, who calls himself the process? That used to be a hairstyle.
Oh, really?
Yeah, man, that was the hairstyle back in the day. James Brown and all these people, you know, they get the process. That's when they did a hot comb to the hair. Come on, y'all know about that.
Wait, so that has to
ask your dad.
I thought that was the cop.
You gotta ask your dad about that.
That has to make you laugh every time then when you see that.
When I see the process, I do.
Wow.
That's hilarious.
I do.
Wait, and
they have a reason. They have a good reason
for
doing it, right? Because Coach Brown is like, okay, I've gone through this process. He said it once. The media picked up on it. And now, you know, now it's a fixture in Philadelphia. But I'm thinking of the hairstyle again.
That's so funny.
I'm thinking of James Brown out there.
Well, as long as we mention the process, I mean, this guy right here on our latest cover, you know him a little bit, Joel Embiid. Yeah. And he's in a city that meant a lot to you. So what do you think of Embiid? And, you know, obviously he's had trouble staying healthy, but what have you seen from him? And
2 years ago, Coach and I had a talk. We were at my event, which he has supported very well over the years. And he said when this kid gets healthy, he's not going to be one of the better centers in the league. He might be the best. So he had that high an expectation of him, you know, from drafting him and just seeing what he saw with the kid was not healthy. So I think the glimpses that we saw this year in the 30 games that he played is pretty indicative that coach knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the kid can step outside. You know, he's a bull down in the low post. He plays with a lot of passion and joy. And it was a good interview,
yeah.
Or whatever. So he's got all the ingredients of really being a superstar, and a super resource for Philadelphia. And, you know, I think when you couple him with Simmons, Bill Simmons, who also has, you know, this extraordinary talent, gifted talent, and size and ability, going to be a tough matchup for anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, when you pair them together, if they're both healthy and they're in sync with coach's system, which is proven San Antonio and other places, you know, to be to give you a chance,
right?
To give you a chance to have 50 win seasons every year, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what has happened in Atlanta, and you know, with most of Pop's disciples,
right,
that are around the league, you're going to have a chance to win, and now you just need those two or three guys, you know, who can just carry you over the top, who can create a little bit of intimidation, who is a tough matchup for somebody, or who you have to double team.
What about Philly just as a city? I know Embiid has really connected with the fans. He's out in the streets all the time, and they love him. What can you sort of either share with us about what it's like, or what have you tried to share with him, and maybe some quick conversations about just connecting with the city?
Yeah. I haven't had that much dialogue with him, you know, and, you know, the whole musical chairs situation, mm-hmm. You know, starting 4 or 5 years ago. You know, I've had very little interaction with the players, and, you know, my role down there has pretty much been with the fans and the season ticket holders, sponsors. So I think it probably in the next 2 years, you know, maybe there'll be room to do more stuff with the players. But they've kind of held the player relationship and the, you know, player responsibility pretty much up to the coaching staff and front office.
But I mean, Philly is such a great sports town. You know, after you guys won the title in, was it 83, correct? You know, I was just looking back, watching, you know, the parade speech, and they packed out. Well, but that was that the Eagles old stadium, or was it the Phillies
Eagles,
old stadium?
Eagles, yeah, Vet Stadium. That's so where the Eagles used to play. Yeah.
Yeah, people are really, you know, diehard Sixers fans. So, you know, it'd just be great for the city to have them back on top.
It would be awesome if they got back on top and they were contending every year. And I think, you know, it's a 7-year plan that was implemented 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Now. So people have their expectations. You know, they lowered the season ticket prices, and they did a lot of things to keep it fan-friendly. And there are a lot of basketball fans in Philadelphia, and they're hungry for a title. You know, they got a taste when, you know, Allen and Dikembe went to the finals, got them back there, and, you know, got the respect back of the 80s teams and the 60s teams or whatever. But, you know, the title is hard to get. I mean, nothing's promised. You know, one injury, you know, takes you out of it. And, you know, you look at Cleveland 2 years ago, you know, and I think they were favored over Golden State. But, you know, they didn't have Love. They didn't have Kyrie. And after the first couple of games, they had Kyrie. Then he was gone. Never had Love and whatever. And, you know, they went down. They came back retooled. And then the injury was on the other side last year with the Warriors. You know, Steph didn't look like Steph. And so it's a very fragile situation. A season is an eternity. You know, when you sit and you plan, man plans, God laughs. It's like, okay, you plan all you want.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, fate will have its due. It always has.
And so you mentioned Iverson, and he's been pretty, like, influential to our magazine and to the sort of slam generation that we grew up in. And one thing that we always talk about and find interesting is that Iverson has completely embraced, like, the current day NBA. He loves Steph Curry. He loves Kyrie Irving in a way that some of the other sort of legends of the game, former players, have not.
Yeah.
You know, occasionally we'll hear older guys. I think Oscar Robertson was one who was very critical of some of today's NBA you know, stylings or certain guys. So where do you kind of fall on that scale of embracing the way that, you know, today's game is played versus some of your peers, even, you know, critical?
Yeah, I don't like seeing the game being dominated by the two guards. I mean, I think it's a shame what has happened to the big man in basketball. You know, I mean, he's he's been kind of like been disenfranchised. And, you know, once upon a time, I mean, if you didn't have a good big man, or at least a good big man, you didn't have a chance. Mm-hmm. But now, with small ball being as effective as it is, the emphasis on scoring versus defending, small ball is big. Teams go small very early, and sometimes they don't change it. They stay and they'll play the rest of the game playing small ball. And you have two centers who will sit on the bench saying, mm-hmm. what am I doing? You know, I got to learn how to move outside. I got to learn how to, you know, play small ball, you right. know? So now you got a big guy, you know, a Shaquille O'Neal type player or whatever, and he's got to learn how to play small ball.
Yeah. He's got to shoot threes.
Come on, that has changed. I mean, the landscape has changed. Mm-hmm. And when one of two guards, Westbrook or Harden, is named MVP this year, it's going to continue to change because teams copy the success of other teams. Players copy the success of other players. So, I kind of sympathize with Oscar Robertson and others. And Oscar was a guard who dominated the play, you know, but he didn't dominate in the way that it's dominated now by most of the backcourts.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think, like, I mean, you sympathize saying that, you know, you don't like guard-dominated ball, or, you know, you wish the big man had more of an impact.
Let me paraphrase a little bit and say it would make my career very different and make my job very different if I had a team like that. Mm. And I had guys who, like, I played with World Be Free and Andrew Toney. I mean, they never met shots that they didn't like. they liked every shot they took or whatever, But crunch time, it was like, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to get the ball to Moses. You're going to get the ball to Doc. You're going to do certain things. So there were enough times during the course of the game where we had a game plan and we had a strategy that was going to be the percentage strategy, that we would have cushions and we would have leads, and then guys could have a little more freedom. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, now you play freelance basketball. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whoever gets it, you know, do your thing. Whatever, but I see that from the beginning of the game. I mean, I watch a lot of games, and I'm like, what's the strategy here? You know, I mean, every time down, they're basically doing the same thing. That guy, somebody's trying to get into the lane and then feed it out to the other guys. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Gene Shue had a playbook like this. Billy Cunningham had a playbook like this. And, you know, the smaller the playbook, the better. Whatever, but there's a playbook nonetheless.
Yeah.
So... it's evolved. Let's chalk it up to evolution.
Yeah. So, you know, triple doubles have become such a hot story this year. Did you guys even think about, you know, getting triple double in the 70s and the early 80s?
I think every time that I had scoring, rebounding, and assists in triple figures, that's basically what it was called. You had a good stat line and, you know, filled a lot of boxes and whatever, but you know, stats are sort of like money. Mm. We didn't really talk about stats, really talk about money. There were certain things that were kind of taboo. You didn't talk about breast cancer. Certainly you just weren't part of general conversation that are now part of general conversation and acceptable conversation. Mm. So that's part of the evolution too. You know, people talk about that, rave about it, make a big deal about it. And, you know, I think when they went back and they looked at the, you know, stats on Oscar Robertson, that his average was triple-double for the whole season, you probably have a lot of guys who were maybe less than triple-double, but still, you know, 14 points, mm-hmm. and 9 rebounds, and 8 assists, mm-hmm. or whatever. You know, you probably had a lot of centers who were like that.
Absolutely.
You know, centers were facilitators during those days. You know, Wilt Chamberlain led the league in scoring, led the league in rebounding, led the league in assists. Bill Russell led the league in scoring. Never in scoring, but rebounding and assists.
I mean, Will would have had triple-doubles with blocks if they counted the stat back then.
Russell, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Russell, too, you know. And then the 5 years that they don't talk about in my career, I mean, I had a lot of nights in which I had triple-doubles. And I remember one game, and Adrian Smith was a player who won the MVP in the NBA All-Star game for the Cincinnati Royals. And it probably was in the 60s. So after he retired with the Royals, he came and played in the ABA. And he was on my team. And he was really a really good shooter. You know, just hit him in the hands and he'd just let it go. And we were playing a game in Richmond, Virginia. And he saw the stats at halftime. And, you know, maybe I had 8 or 9 assists and whatever. So he's like, this half, you just keep giving it to me. He said, you just keep giving it to me because I'm going to make every shot that you give.
Yeah.
So at the end of the game, I had like 16 assists. Wow. I usually score 30 points, 15 rebounds, 16 assists or whatever. But nobody ever talked about it as a triple-double. I think that the phrase was coined by Riley and Magic, you know, in Magic's run, the triple-double and the three-peat and, you know, certain things that, you know, came along with, you know, people's hunger for something new and different to talk about. And that's what got talked about. Mm-hmm. So how significant it is and, you know, is it a real statistic? It has become a real statistic. Mm-hmm. You know, the triple-double has become a real statistic, but really it's just a compilation of three different statistics that are, you know, that are there. And I think it's happened a lot of times with people with block shots, you know, with double-digit block shots. Or I don't know how many times it's happened with double-digit steals. That's probably rare to get scoring rebounds and steals.
Yeah,
I've seen 9. I've seen 8 and 9, mm-hmm. you know. And with the ABA and NBA combined, when I retired, I was number one in steals. And they didn't keep steals for 2 years. Mm-hmm. My first 2 years, they didn't keep track of steals.
Wow.
Or whatever. So I think I had a few 9s in there. I don't know about 10s. Just a few. I don't know about 10s or 11s. But I'll let you do the homework on that.
All right. So all that being said, who is your pick for MVP this year? Because we mentioned a few names
I'm
in there.
I'm going with Westbrook.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm going with Westbrook.
I am too, by the way.
Yeah. I don't see anything happening the rest of the season that would be more impactful in terms of what that vote is all about. And, you know, the argument clearly, I mean, you know, Harden's in the running, Curry and Durant. Durant was probably one of the favorite guys. LeBron's always in the running. Mm-hmm. Kyrie should be in the running.
I mean, your guy, Kawhi Leonard.
He definitely should be in the running. You're right. But Westbrook gets a lot of news. Isaiah Thomas should be in the running.
Yeah, absolutely.
You think?
Yeah.
So I'll go with Westbrook.
Yeah. So I just got just a few more before we wrap up here. You know, in the 86-87 season, which was your last, you know, you went on a bit, I guess, you know, retirement tour of sorts where you were honored.
Farewell tour. Yeah.
Where you were honored and, you know, Boston, notably, LA, notably, you know, what was that experience like for you? Like, did you like, you know, getting all these gifts and giving speeches in front of away crowds and all that?
It just sounded like it was like, it sounded like a lot of fun. And then I broke my finger. So it was like 20 games I didn't have to play.
Yeah.
I just had to show up in a suit and tie and, you know, accept gifts, make a little speech.
Yeah.
But I tried to, you know, cater each speech to the city. And, you know, what my experiences had been in the city and how the fans had appreciated me and the other teams, the respect that, you know, we had as competitors. So I always had, you know, a 3 or 4 minute speech. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew that the last time around, you know, it was very emotional. I found myself when we had the farewell tour with the Nets. In particular, man, I couldn't keep the water out of my eyes. I was crying like a baby. And I was like, you know, Whitney Houston came out and sang. My mom was there. And then they had the banner come down with my number on it, you know, from the 32 from the Nets days. And I'm like, how much can one person take? You know, it was like, I couldn't even play. Like, before the game started, I don't even know where I was. I was in La La Land.
Yeah.
It took like the whole half. And I think I might have had 2 points in the first half. Whatever. And then second half, it's like a wake-up call. You know, you need to play. You get paid to play. Forget all this farewell stuff. you need to play. Like, okay. I think I can give you like 12.
Yeah. I mean, it's just so rare to see that. I mean, for my memory, I can only
John Havlicek had a nice farewell tour.
I mean, Kobe most recently.
Kobe had a most recent one. And I remember Maurice Lucas when he was retiring. Like, we were going to lunch or dinner or something because we were good friends. And I was like, man, you need to tell the team a year before so you can get a farewell tour. He said, man, people be giving me hatchets and stuff. I'm not going to do that. He said, I ain't doing that. I said, come on, Maurice. People like you, man.
All right. Like Peter said, you know, only a couple more. But we wanted to definitely get your thoughts on a couple current NBA newsworthy things that are happening. Mm-hmm. I think probably the biggest debate going on right now as far as the league is the whole rest issue, you know, as far as guys taking games off, you know, Coach Pop sitting all his guys at once.
Yeah.
Where do you come down on that whole topic? Do you think, you know, these guys should be playing every time when they're healthy? Are you okay with guys sitting out games? Like, where do you fall on that?
Well, I think the last month of the season, you know, it shouldn't even be an issue before the last month of the season.
So guys should play.
If guys usually, are healthy
usually isn't
and capable,
yeah.
they should play. When you get to the last month of the season, you know, now you have to think about resting your players and getting ready for the playoffs. Generally, your playoff position is secured. And, you know, I mean, we had a thing on our good teams, the Nets and with the Sixers, you know, where play for a quarter, sit for three. You know, so the fans still get a chance to see star players play. You can have an impact on the game because you can set the tone and you can set the stage, you know, for the game. You know, the whole idea of sitting out when you're healthy, if it's a meaningful game, I mean, you know, you're kind of defeating the purpose of calling it competition. It's not competition, you know, so so I think it's always existed in basketball and it's been, you know, more of an unspoken rule rather right. than a rule or whatever. But, you know, copycat once again, some teams have had relative success. San Antonio's had great success. And, you know, I mean, with Tony Parker and Ginobili, I think, you know, you need to rest those guys. Yeah. I mean, a lot of miles have been on those legs. I would rest those two. I don't think you need to rest Kawhi. You don't need to rest Aldridge. You know, Gasol, maybe, you know, he's been around for a while. But, you know, I don't think you should be blatant with it and say, well, I'm just doing this because I'm doing this and screw the fans, because that's not in the real good spirit of sportsmanship, you know, or, you know, from an economic standpoint, people, you know, paying several hundred dollars or several thousand dollars for tickets. And, you know, you're just sitting the guy out because you said, because you can, you know, you have to offer some sort of explanation. And people are reasonable. I mean, they would accept an explanation that says, okay, you know, last year at this time, you know, he was tired going into the playoffs. And it's the last month of the season. I need to cut his minutes. I need to cut his minutes and have him sit out some games.
And I think, you know, just to combine a couple of things we talked about, Westbrook and Harden have played every single game. So I think people really respect that as far as the MVP race, too.
For sure.
Yeah, for sure. That's true, too.
You want to ask him about the Converse line?
Yeah, I think we have to. One of the things that we were talking about on the way over is that, you know, you were really the first to get a sneaker deal. And you got, what was it,
$20,000?
1974 Converse.
1974.
Throws the bag at you, or what was the bag at that time? Is it crazy to you that, like, I mean, there's literally like one pair of sneakers could be worth like a couple thousand dollars now, and that the sneaker deals these guys get.
Well, a couple of thousand, like 15,000.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
I've gone to Vegas and seen this one store, and they got these shoes in the window. like 15,000.
Yeah,
that for who, for what?
That was your whole deal at the time.
For who, for what? I mean, are you kidding? So, yeah, but only a sucker would buy those sneakers, I think.
True. Great point.
Unless it, was a unless it was a collector's item.
And, right.
You know, when Michael Jordan was selling his house, I think he was offering X number of pair of sneakers with the house as part of the deal.
For sure.
Or whatever. So, yeah, marketing is, you know, it's unlimited. It's only limited by somebody's lack of imagination. Mm-hmm. You come up with it. If somebody will buy it, it could be sand in the desert. And if they buy it, then it's a good deal for the person who sold it. And probably not so good a deal for the person who bought it, but they bought it because their emotions at that time said, hey, yeah, I want this because X, Y, or Z is selling it, you know? And I've seen that evolve. I've looked at it a lot of ways because I have four sons and three daughters, right? So we're going to SneakerCon. We're going to SneakerCon over in Paris because we just happened to be over there and the SneakerCon was going on.
Wait, hold on.
And we've gone and...
go to SneakerCon. There's a lot of like nerdy sneaker people there. Do they know who you are? I hope they do.
Yeah, they know.
Okay,
yeah,
thank God.
They know. But if I got my kids with me, you know, it's just like, all right, with family, they're with their family. We're cool. And, you know, sometimes the kids would get together and start negotiating. My kids come there with a box of sneakers. And my daughter came. She had like three or four pairs of sneakers. She sold them all and whatever to another kid who was, you know, there with his sneakers. And, you know, so I think it's an interesting exchange. I mean, it's a culture unto itself. And I don't hate on it at all. I mean, mm-hmm. I look at it and I said, you know, this is something they enjoy. It's fun for them. It's in a good spirit. You know, it's clean and on the streets, just hanging, drinking, smoking, doing crazy stuff. Let's have SneakerCon all the time.
But I mean, you're partly, you know, responsible for that, being that, you know, you were the first big sneaker endorser. So, you know, do you take like a little bit of pride in knowing that, you know, you see like SneakerCon and you're like, man, I'm Dr. J. Like, be no SneakerCon without Dr.
Yeah.
J.
Well, I think it was more of a 90s thing and, you know, 21st century thing, more so than during my era, you know. And I could just remember my first pair of Converse or U.S. Kids or whatever and just wearing them until there was a hole in the bottom. And then, you know, the sock was coming out of the hole. And then you put some cardboard in there for a while until you get a new pair. But we wore a pair of sneakers until we wore them down.
Yeah.
I mean, the rubber was smooth in the bottom. You couldn't even see the crosses at the bottom. Or whatever. So now, you know, I mean, now it's more of a fad. Wear them once and now shoot or market them because somebody will buy your used goods.
Yeah.
But it's an exciting thing. It's an exciting experience to do once. And I've done it multiple times.
Mm. All right, Julius, we know you got a lot to do today. Appreciate you taking time. Okay. Really was a pleasure. Hope to do it again someday. Yeah.
All right.
Thanks
so
much.
We'll chop it up again.
Yeah.
All right.
You know? All good.
Oh, wait. Quickly give us a finals prediction on the way out. Who wins it this year?
I think it's going to be a rematch.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, it looks like it's going to be a rematch. Unless San Antonio has something to say about it. If Durant doesn't come back, then, you know, there's a chance that the Spurs or the Rockets will get in there. You know, Toronto, Boston, Washington.
Wizards are hot.
Yeah. 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 I mean, any of them can, you know, once again, the injury thing.
Yep.
So if somebody significant goes down on one of the teams that you're predicting, then that opens the door for somebody else. And just like that Portland team, they got hot. Teams gets on a hot streak. Doesn't matter what happened during the regular season. They just start to believe that they can't lose and they find a way to become more united. And move as a unit and do things as a unit. So that can happen to any of the top four teams. It'd be hard for the bottom three and maybe fifth place team, which is like Atlanta and Portland or whatever. You know, they have a chance. Portland's guards always give them a chance. But it should be interesting. But more than likely, it'll be Cleveland and Golden State.
Yeah, we think so too.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Thank you so much,
man.
Appreciate
you guys.
All right.